From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 439 of Sunday House Call for this May the 5th, 2013. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we're going to be taking your calls very shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. Anything you'd like to discuss, anything you've heard in the news lately, any questions you have about your own or family's or friends' specific medical issues, need more information, need to know how to access some of the information or how to get around in the system a bit, might be able to help you with some of that. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number, and encourage you to call in earlier rather than later. And I wanted to start off with some experiences I've had this week talking to some people at the Ottawa General Hospital in the case room. These are the nurses in the case room. These are excellent people, a great group. I've worked with them. Some have come and gone just over the years, but I have been delivering babies at the Ottawa General since 1991, around that time, and have known some of them that have been there for 20 years as well. And you've known about the budget cuts that have come to hospitals as a result of the government sort of downloading their debt onto hospitals, and the hospitals stuck with shortages, and as a result, they had to cut nursing staff. Well, in the case room, normally there should be, there were 13 nurses at any given time. They've now reduced that to 12. And there are 12 nurses that are there Monday to Friday and usually runs from 7:30 till 3:30. Now it is being reduced after 3:30, from around 3:30 to 7:30, goes down to 11. And after 7:30, it goes down to 10. Now you say, well, that doesn't sound too bad. 10 nurses for the ward. There are 10 birthing rooms. And the idea is to provide one-on-one care. Obviously, if you are in labor, you want to have the same person, or as much as possible, have the same person looking after you. There's a rapport that builds up, and it is professionally satisfying for the nurses as well to be looking after that one patient and getting to know them and looking after their needs during this time. But that's not what happens. And the reason this doesn't happen is, again, when you consider the shortages, when they had 13 nurses, made it a little easier, because with 10, and a lot of times there are nurses that are calling in sick, you need to have out of the, let's just start with the 12, and remember that's only in the daytime, so that keep in mind that as the evening where comes on, there are two less nurses by the time you reach 7:30, so you're dealing with 10. So let's just say overnight you come in, there are 10 nurses. You need to have one nurse as the charge nurse. So they're not seeing patients, they're overseeing everybody else. They're managing things, they're monitoring what's going on in the case room, and they play an extremely important role. You then have one nurse in triage. So they are in the front. When you come into the general and you come up to the 8th floor, the first place you come to before you get to the case room is the triage, where they will assess the woman who comes in. She may be in labor, she may have some bleeding, she may have some pain, but it's to assess what's going on to see if they need to go over to the case room. So there's one triage nurse, and you need to have one operating room nurse available at all times. So they can't be seeing patients, because if there is a cesarean section, they need to be setting up the OR and getting it ready to do the surgery. So right away, you have three nurses taken off that staff. So if you had 12, you know, have 9. And if you had 10, which is, again, after 7:30, you know, you now have 7. So you now have 7 nurses, and you have 10 rooms. And sometimes those rooms, and a lot of times those rooms, are fully occupied. So you now are not getting one-on-one care. Now, very commonly, somebody has to go for a cesarean section. Something happens, an emergency happens, they go for cesarean section. Cesarean section takes up three nurses. So now you take off three more nurses, and you're left with two to three nurses, maybe four nurses, left for the entire floor while that cesarean section is ongoing. And a lot of times you have more than one cesarean section done during the day. So you now have women in labor in each of their own rooms with nurses that are understaffed and trying to provide one-on-one care when, and very difficult to do so when you have multiple patients for which the system was not designed to do. It was designed to be one-on-one care. And while I was there, because they were having these staffing problems and they could not get, and there were nurses that were calling in sick, they could not get a nurse to come in, they're working 12-hour shifts. So the solution from human resources, and I saw this firsthand, the solution from human resources was to tell the nurses, well, work another 4 hours. So in other words, don't work 12 hours, work 16 hours, and then come back the next day to work. I don't know about you, but that borders on abuse for people who are trying to literally run themselves off their feet to provide care to patients that they are for whom they are responsible. And I don't think this will bode well over the long term, because what will happen is that by demanding more and more time from each of these nurses within the case room setting, they will burn out. And it'll set up a vicious cycle. The more that you burn out, the less availability of staff, the more the remaining staff have to work harder. Those that are working harder will then burn out, and round and around it goes. And it will eventually impact quality of care, if not to a certain extent already. But they are doing a great job trying to cover the holes that are there in order to make sure that everybody gets good care. And they indeed, to be fair, the patients are getting excellent care. There have been no serious complications with regards to providing patient care. And I can assure everybody that goes there to deliver their babies that they will get excellent care. So that is not an issue now. But you want a staff that is not demoralized. You want a staff that is happy. You want a staff that is looked after. And I know that the hospital is in a difficult position with regards to allocating resources and allocating money. But I don't think this is the best way to go about it, especially in the case room. And again, I'm not blaming the hospital per se, but what really bothers me is, and you know this as well, is all the money that has been wasted in e-health and in Orange and in gas plants, and on it goes. You think of the billions of dollars that are wasted that could have been used. Literally fractions and fractions of a percent of that money could go to the hospital to keep the nursing staff at the level that they were originally. And yet they have to cut because of the relative incompetence of the present government to be able to manage your finances. And I don't want to make the show political, but it always comes up when you come up with these shortages, and when you have people say, you know, the healthcare system has no money. To a point, that's true, that it's the largest line item in the budget. But nevertheless, it still is frustrating when money is being wasted for no reason whatsoever, and we end up with these shortages. So just I'd give you that information and let you know. If I would encourage you to call the hospital if you're pregnant as well, to call the hospital and ask what their policies are and what they're going to do to try and rectify this situation. I think the nurses deserve your support. As I mentioned, they are excellent at what they do. I depend on them when I'm there. When they call me and they tell me something is up, I know they're right, and they're so well honed to what is going on with the patients that you'd be very foolish not to take what they tell you at face value and act on it. They really know their stuff. And I think it's discouraging to me, and especially to them, that their specific desire to want to provide the care that they've been trained to do is being made more difficult because of these specific policies. We're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we're going to take your calls. We have, I believe, Robert in Canada. And if I think it's the Robert who called last time, I'm happy to hear from him. I really appreciate his calls and his insight into things. Other lines are available, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in several minutes.
I'm a professional doctor.
Do you think you should call him and apologize?
Yes, he's a doctor.
Mr. Evil.
Dr. Evil. I didn't spend 6 years in evil medical school to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dr. Nick.
This is a house of learned doctors. You're not a doctor.
The doctor said I wouldn't have so many nosebleeds if I kept my finger out of there.
There's one doctor who does make house calls.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. Still have lots of lines available. Looking forward to speaking with you today. And we're going to go to line one, and good afternoon to Robert in Canada.
Good day, Professor Dworkin. Given that you're talking about hospitals, I'm glad to throw in any input that I can.
Sure.
I'm in the process of getting a meeting with Dr. Kitts about the superbug problems in the hospitals, which is going to cost a lot of money. It's a $20 billion business in Canada yearly. You are mentioning cutbacks for nurses, which is putting them in peril. We're facing, once again, the death of 1,000 cuts, right?
Yes, we are.
In the system, systemically. If you'll hearken back to amalgamation and the Harris government and the beginnings of the LHINs, we had these same problems back then. Everything was shutting down. The architecture wasn't working for distribution and transferring of wealth. So I guess the heads out of Toronto decided to form the LHINs. Then amalgamation came in, the LHINs came in, and we were promised that things would correct. Now we've gone full circle again. We are faced with ushering back in the progressive conservatives, and we're being faced with the reevaluation of the LHINs and their mandate. Now, if we look at the cutbacks in the department you're talking about,
right?
Those nurses aren't, you know, they're not sunshine listers, I don't think, like or just barely.
No, but even if they were, the work that they are doing is quite valuable.
Sure, and they would be worth it, but I'll bet you they're not even at the ceiling of being on the list. Okay, I'll bet you they're making 75, probably around that. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I didn't ask them what their salary
but
was.
But I'm upset for the disparity in terms of the structure and in the system in terms of pay. Okay, so we have the cutbacks occurring at the bottom end in nursing, but not cutbacks with respect to doctor salaries or management salaries. Now, if we look at the salary that Dr. Kitts makes, he makes $750,000, and I'm sure he's a good manager, okay? Good CEO of that hospital. But if we look at our own mayor, Mayor Watson, and we divide Mayor Watson's salary into Dr. Kitt's salary. Mayor Watson's salary divides into his salary 4.2 times.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in highlighting that structural disparity in terms of management, I think if we cut back on management, you know, what I'm saying is I think if we halved Dr. Kitt's salary, we could still get similar management and we could hire more nurses. And if it's a matter of where do you get the money, they've been taking the money out of the bottom end of the structure or bottom end of the system and putting it into the top end of the system. So we're top heavy on management and we're not getting the basics accomplished. And the stress is not put onto the upper tier of management. It is put onto your nurses that you're talking about. So, you know, and they're booking off sick.
Yeah.
And the more they, you know, wither away at their daily routine, the more they will book off sick. So we're headed for the polls soon. And, you know, this is all going to come up. Salaries at upper tier management, the LHINs, you know, what are the progressive conservatives going to do with respect to cutbacks in the hospitals and the, you know, degradation that's that has occurred over the last, you know, 4 years anyways.
Right.
So we're in trouble, and we have to start looking at what is management doing? Why are we paying... Mayor Watson is a damn good manager, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a better manager in this city.
Right.
And I don't think Dr. Kitt's is really up there in terms of management with respect to, you know, Mayor Watson. So I don't, you know, it's just so perturbing to me to hear you talk about your nurses, and they need you to speak out for them, and we hear nothing about anyone saying anything about upper tier management, which has taken the lion's share of the money, and it's not coming back down. It's like the bankers, you know, investment bankers saying, okay, if you bail us out, we'll give money to the banks. But the money isn't trickling down. And, you know, it's just what's happening in your hospital is a microcosm of exactly what's happening in society.
Well, I think you're right. And one of the things you said, Robert, was that, you know, it doesn't matter what government is in place. It seems the same thing happens over and over again. So I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the commonality between all the governments, despite the rhetoric of what they're going to do, how they're going to save health care?
We need stability aside from the political instability that is, you know, foisted upon us 2 years before an election, every go-round.
Right. Well, I think that I think what we need to be doing as well, if we broaden this a little bit, is to, again, we have to look at other systems in the world that have universal coverage and say, what are they doing? What parts of it are doing that provide better outcomes? Because when you look at outcomes for certain segments of our healthcare system, we don't rank that great compared to some of the other countries.
No, actually, we've fallen tremendously. You know what the best hospital is in this whole region? Smiths Falls. They have the highest ranking. Okay, yeah. Ottawa, the Ottawa Hospital has like 29th or something.
Well, but to be fair, again, the size of the hospital and whether it's a tertiary or primary hospital makes a difference, because the resources and the patient complications, the illnesses, you know, and
I just think we're falling by the wayside here. We're supposed to be, you know, this is our nation's capital.
Mm-hmm.
We are the best damn country in the world with the greatest resources. We should have a system that is functioning, you know, adequately, and it is so below the mark.
I share your sentiments, Robert, with regards to the frustration about how the system works, and I think the only way things will change, and I think this is the unfortunate conclusion I've made, is that the only way this will change is when the system falls apart.
Because, so you're saying let it crash?
No, I'm not saying let it crash. I'm saying what human behavior is, and you know this, is that people only react when there's a crisis.
Well,
otherwise,
but we're in one. You know,
I know that,
and I know we're in one.
But they don't want to admit that there is one. That's
who are they?
Each government that we have in there. doesn't acknowledge that it's a crisis. They always say that they're going to keep on the same road and keep going the way they're going.
Including Stephen Harper's government.
Harper doesn't cover provincial health care.
But
right, so
the provincial health care gets a federal transfer.
It does, but by law, it's the provinces that look after the health after their own health care. But Rob, we have to go for a break, but I appreciate your call. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. And we'll take a small break for the news and come back with your calls. Our lines are available. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long-distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in just a few minutes.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Five two one talk 521-8255 star 580 on Bell Mobility 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. We have all the lines available, and you are making me talk to myself today, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to do that. I know it's a beautiful day outside, but it'd be nice to hear from you. 521-TALK 521-8255 star 580 on Bell Mobility 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And there is an interesting study that comes out of the Cohen Children's Medical Center of New York. And they were looking at whether specialists and pediatricians were following medical guidelines when treating preschoolers for ADHD. As you know, there has been an increase in the diagnoses of ADHD. I have my own views of some of those diagnoses and why they're occurring. But for the moment, let's just focus on the diagnosis and what they found. And what they found is that the guidelines regarding using medications to treat young patients with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, is such that you don't go to medications right away. You go to behavioral therapy first before you even try medical therapy. And unfortunately, 90% are not following those guidelines. They're not using the recommended behavior therapy as first-line treatment. The study also found that 1 in 5 specialists who diagnose and manage ADHD in preschoolers recommend pharmacotherapy as a first-line treatment alone or in conjunction with behavior therapy, and that they are not using the medication, the first-line medication, which is methylphenidate or Ritalin. More than one-third of specialists who prescribe medication said they often or very often choose a different medication other than Ritalin as their first-line drug. So guidelines aren't being followed, so you may want to, I mean, again, this applies to the United States, doesn't apply to any Canadian physicians, they weren't in the study, so all we can say is that in the U.S., this is what we're seeing. But nevertheless, that's pretty troubling. There are guidelines are there for specific reasons. Hopefully, they have been developed on the basis of the available evidence and the analyses of many studies to come up with a conclusion. And if that is the case, and to not follow them means that you are not following best practices. So it's just disconcerting when you see something like that, especially for children and prescribing medications for children. You got to wonder what's going on. Going to go to line one and speak to Miranda in Greeley. Good afternoon.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin. I didn't want you to talk all by yourself.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
I'm just calling for a sort of a second opinion.
Yes.
My rheumatologist wants to put me on Enbrel. I've mm-hmm. been fighting him not to take it because I'm really scared of that drug. What do you think about it? I have rheumatoid arthritis.
I think the medication, you've probably tried other medications before this.
Right now, I'm on methotrexate 9 a week.
Yeah, and it's not working for you.
And Plaquenil.
Right, but it's not working for you.
Well,
right?
I can't lift my right arm anymore.
Yeah. Enbrel, I have patients who are on Enbrel, and I have to tell you, Miranda, that it works very well for them.
Okay.
Whenever you are taking a medication, you have to gauge, you know, if you're taking Enbrel, there are blood tests that are done on a regular basis to see the effect of the medication.
Right.
So you are literally, by doing those blood tests, using an early warning system. So if something comes up on the blood test and says, oh, look, the Enbrel is having this negative effect on a particular blood value, if you stop the Enbrel, it reverses itself, so the damage disappears.
Okay.
But with rheumatoid arthritis, what we do know, and as you have experienced, it progresses, and it becomes worse, and your quality of life gets worse, and your ability to do what you want to do becomes severely impacted. So the Enbrel can help reverse a lot of that process, can actually stop the progression of the disease and improve your quality of life.
But what about infections and that? Like if I am around somebody who has a cold or something, mm-hmm. should I be really worried about that?
Not usually. Again, with my patients that are on Enbrel and they're in their mid-50s or 60s, the Enbrel is not an immunosuppressant to the point that it stops you from responding to illnesses. Methotrexate also is an immunosuppressant.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So the idea that taking the Enbrel will put you more at risk, not necessarily so. I mean, as with anything, you know, you have to monitor how someone is doing. So if you get a cold, of course, we'll watch you a little bit more, but most people, whether the colds, your immune system works well enough to eradicate colds. There are certain vaccines that you may get to protect you from pneumonia. So there are other things that can be done to protect you from more serious illnesses. Mm-hmm. But if your rheumatologist mm-hmm. is recommending it, and your rheumatologist is actually following the guidelines, right? He or she started off with other medications, anti-inflammatories, moved up to methotrexate. And if methotrexate doesn't work, the next step usually is using Enbrel. Mm-hmm. And it's based on the data that is out there that shows that it is quite effective. Certainly, it's a step up for methotrexate in terms of, you know, potential for side effects, but it also is a step up in terms of the potential to help guard against the disease.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty healthy besides the rheumatoid arthritis.
Right, but you don't want that rheumatoid arthritis to destroy your joints and your hands to the point that you can't do what you want
yeah,
to do.
That's right.
And so that's why I think it's important to be as aggressive as possible in treating this, because the other side of it is that if you just stick with the methotrexate and it's not working, you're going to end up with more and more complications from your disease.
Well, that makes me feel better. I'm seeing him next week. I'm sure he'll be happy
right.
that I finally say yes.
All right, Miranda.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to go to line two and say good afternoon to Dan in Ottawa.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi, Dan.
I'm calling about my ulcerative colitis.
Yes.
I was first diagnosed, 1967, and mm-hmm. I've had a few flare-ups, but not really very many.
Right.
But I'm having one now.
Okay.
The first one in over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
In about 10 years, I guess.
And do they consider it mild, moderate, or severe when they've mentioned it to you?
I don't know. They've never really said.
Okay.
It's always been treated with, Asacol.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I am taking, so... It first started to flare up in January, sort of mild, got a bit worse. I went to see the gastro.
Yep.
He prescribed a suppository.
Okay.
Okay, along with the maintenance dose of Asacol.
Okay.
I went to see him a few weeks later because it wasn't responding that well, and so he increased the dose of the Asacol mm-hmm. to, 3,200 milligrams.
Right.
Twice, like in two doses.
Mm-hmm.
plus the 1 gram suppository at bedtime.
Okay, and are you getting...
So
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I've been taking that for about 2 months now. I'm going to see the gastro this week. I have made some progress, but I'm still bleeding from time to time, and my bowel movements still are not they can be quite liquidy.
Sure. Any bleeding?
Sorry.
Any bleeding or blood noted as well? Or
yes. Yes. I still have some bleeding. Some days none.
Okay.
Other days I will have some.
Okay.
Typically, it's more evident on the toilet paper than in the water, at the toilet bowl.
Right.
I have improved the frequency. My bowel movement frequency has decreased to maybe 2, sometimes 3 in a day.
Right.
Which isn't so bad when you're looking at 10, 15.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically where I'm at. I feel that I have made some progress with the drugs, but... It's still, I think I've got a ways to go yet. So I'm just wondering what kind of questions should I suggest that I try another medication?
Sure.
What kind of questions should I have for the gastroenterologist when I see him?
Sure. Well, what you're describing sounds like moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. So the guidelines for that usually are exactly what you've done so far, which is start with the acicol. But if the acicol is not working, the next step is, I didn't hear if you were taking any oral steroids or anything along with that or not.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No.
So some of the things you may want to discuss, because there's a stepwise approach to treating ulcerative colitis. They're starting with the acicol, followed by using hopefully short-term oral steroids to try and bring it down. And if this is not working, that is, if you have severe symptoms despite doses of normal or therapeutic doses of oral steroids and high doses of the acicol, they usually will recommend hospitalization for further management. That's one of the options. The other is if someone, despite the use of steroids and acicol for a period of 12 months, having two relapses, that is, if they're treating this and it's either not getting any better or it's just... it gets better, but then it comes back again. You then move on to some of the other drugs. One is called 6-mercaptopurine, or 6-MP is the name of it, or 6-mercaptopurine or azathioprine. And there's also a medication called Remicade. And Remicade is sort of a what they call an anti-tumor necrosis factor medication. And those have very good evidence for use with regards to calming down the intestine and putting you into remission. So the discussion should be the stepwise approach to treating ulcerative colitis, given that the acicol is not controlling it. The questions I would ask is, are we moving over to steroids? If we're moving on to steroids, how long are we going to use this to determine whether it's effective? If it's not effective, how long do we wait before determining if we're going to use 6-mercaptopurine? And Remicade is the last option. I mean, Remicade's a fortune as well, and I hope you have insurance if it comes to that, because it's $5,000 a shot. it's very expensive. But so those are some of the questions that I would ask with regards to your management of this, because you're really at the ground floor right now using just the acicol. And likely when they meet with you, if you're not any better, it is going to mean using something else, likely the steroids, but they may want to skip that and move on to the mercaptopurine, given your history of longstanding ulcerative colitis. So that's sort of the framework I would suggest you use when you speak to them.
Okay. Would there be any point in going with something like sulfasalazine?
You could, but again, if you're already using the acicol, it is a form of ASA, right? It's very similar in how it works. So it may not necessarily give you that benefit. And again, with ulcerative colitis, what you want to see is improvement, because you don't want the bowel to continually deteriorate, because then it becomes much more difficult to get you under control.
Right, right. Okay, I will bring all those points up with him.
All right, Dan, I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break. We have some lines available and also some people waiting online. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and back to your calls in just a few minutes.
They were talking about in health class how pregnancy, it can often lead to an infant.
Okay, at each contraction, you need to tell Shirley to push.
That's it?
Well, don't tell any doctors I said this, but at this point in time, the bus pretty much drives itself.
Hey, nurse. Quick, give this man some drugs. Quick, catch his season pain.
No.
Give her a shot, quickly.
Liability waiver.
Don't read it, just sign it. It simply says you won't hold us responsible if you die as a result of gross negligence. It's a standard form.
Nice. If I had it all to do over again, there's only one thing I do.
What's that?
I go to medical school.
Back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Jerry in Armprior.
Hello.
Hi, Jerry.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too badly. I just had a question with regard to neuropathy. It's a peripheral neuropathy resulting from chemotherapy treatment.
Yes.
And my treatment finished at the end of February, but and prior to that, I had a cold sensitivity in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, that's sort of turned into a like numbness in my both my feet and my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering whether there's any kind of treatment or a therapy that could deal with that, or how long it might last, or whether it's permanent or not.
Right. Now, how long were you on the chemotherapy?
For 6 months.
Okay.
Like for 12 treatments every 2 weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll be able to answer this for you, Jerry, because I'm not sure exactly, what medication did they use? Like what?
It was Fulfox. It was a product you sort of took home and wore this, what they call a baby bottle for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of was every 2 weeks for 6 months. And say during that time, this sensitivity to cold grew more severe or, increased. And then after the treatment was finished, as I said before, it turned to numbness in my feet and my hands.
Now, are you getting pain as well, or is it just the numbness?
No, there's no pain, just the numbness, yeah.
Well, what I would say is that in terms of other conditions, no diabetes, no heart, no blood pressure problems, nothing along those
lines.
Well,
blood pressure, but yeah.
Okay. Well, what we do know about nerves and the numbness is usually because the nerves are likely, there's been some damage in those nerves.
As a product of taking the chemotherapy.
It's possible. I'm not sure because I'm not sure what the mechanism would be for that to happen.
Yeah,
but if we make that assumption, let's just say we make that assumption that the medication led to that, peripheral nerves, that is the nerves that provide sensation to, the hands, the feet, the arms, that sort of radiate outwards, as long as they haven't been cut, they tend to grow back.
Right.
And so because there are literally little tubes or tunnels that they grow in. So say, for example, there's a crush injury, right? So there's a crush injury to an arm and it causes nerve damage.
Yeah.
Anything past that area that's been crushed down and away from the body. So say, let's just say, for example, you got your leg compressed below the knee. Well, anything from that area down to your feet can get numb. And then the nerves grow back about a millimeter a day. So if so that means for every 100 days, it will extend about 10 centimeters. And given that a leg is, 30 or 40 centimeters long, or a lower leg, 40 or even 50 centimeters, you're looking at a lot of days before the nerves grow back.
Right, right.
So you stopped the chemo how long ago?
The end of February. So
it's
2 months.
So it's still fairly early.
Yeah.
What I would say is that we'll know for sure whether this is unfortunately, it's a time factor, but whether this is a permanent or temporary phenomenon, usually if we look, say, another, you know, if another 100 days is 10 centimeters, so say about 150, 200 days from now, you'll know whether...
This year?
Yeah, well, pretty much, because, you know, part of the problem is that when nerves regenerate, there is a set rate at which they repair themselves, and you can't speed that up. So really, the only answer is... The answer will be there in that time. So if you're still numb at that time, you can pretty much assume that that's going to be permanent. But and it's not as if it's the 100 or 200 days, and on the 200th day you're going to know. There's going to be a gradual improvement in sensation, and the numbness, you'll get pins and needles, and the you know, it'll gradually start returning, which will be a positive thing. So that's what you're kind of looking for. So, but more than that, Jerry, it's we really can't answer that question.
No therapy or anything else that you sort of take medicinally that would enhance that at all?
Not really, because you're really dependent on the nerve cells themselves to regenerate.
Right.
And so it is then a matter of just eating very well. You want to give it as much as it can in order to repair itself.
Right.
So, you know, and also exercise will help. That is, walking will help. And the reason walking helps is it helps build collateral blood vessel distribution. That is, you'll get tiny arteries that respond to the increased work that you're doing in your legs. And as a result of that, again, the more blood flow you have to the lower legs, the greater the chance of the nerves get to grow, because they get all the nutrients from blood supply.
Right.
So well,
they're getting lots of exercise, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are some of the options. Now, are you doing well after the chemo? Has it worked for you?
Well, it's worked. I've had. I guess they take these trace tests, and I think there's another one coming up in June sometime.
Mm-hmm.
But that'll at least the one I've taken had so far has sort of said the treatment was successful.
Okay.
Yeah.
What were you being treated for?
Colon cancer.
Okay. Was it localized, or did you have any surgery?
I had surgery last July.
Okay.
Yeah. So they took, you know, a good swath of the intestine.
Right.
But, you know, I thought that was going to be the worst part, but...
The chemo's pretty tough.
The chemo's in itself. Yeah. I can't complain because other people have it worse than I do, but still, you know, it's a personal thing. And
absolutely.
I like to think there's a solution to it or an end to it. Yeah.
So have they... There are no tumors anywhere else? It's all cleared up?
Well, not that I'm aware of. I guess they'll do another colonoscopy sometime this summer, and then they'll know then. But I think they thought things that they caught what was there last July, and hopefully that's going
to
be it.
So it was confined to the bowel. They caught it early.
Yeah.
Was it a screening test that you had done to find it, or was there a specific complaint or something that was going on?
Well, it was fatigue and that kind of thing initially, and then the colonoscopy proved.
Found it.
Yeah, I found it, yeah.
Well, I'm glad they found it earlier for you, Jerry, because that bodes very well for you.
Well, I was around for a while before that. I've learned since then. I've had it for some time, so...
Right, but it stayed in the intestine. It didn't spread anywhere else.
So, yes, yeah.
That's good to hear.
Okay.
Well, all the best to you, Jerry. I hope things work out for you. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
My apologies to Peter and Sarah. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. We will be back again next week with another edition of Sunday House Call and be able to answer your questions. My thanks to Dave Tripp for producing Sunday House Call. And yes, we'll be back again next week. Have a great week.
I saw her today at the reception.